Do you ever wish you didn't have to choose between something being smart or pleasant? Well, I have good news. When it comes to coffee, you can have it all. Of course, I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug is premium and fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, even decaf and half calf. But what really makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this outstanding coffee to you in your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. It's completely flexible and customizable. It's got all the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order, which is helpful if you're ordering for yourself and your puka. So what are you waiting for? There's never been a better time to upgrade your coffee at home, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I prefer martinis. But maybe some coffee the next day when I need to fix my hangover.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Good day, good friends, and thank you for putting the 367th Ellis's Analysis into your great big floppy bunny ears. We're the Classic Movies podcast that looks back at and spoils films from long ago. If you'd be delighted to hear us speak about the 123 AFI classics that they rank on their 1998 and 2007 lists, and Jimmy Stewart stars in five of those, lest we forget, go find those in the early days of the Top 100 Project, way back years ago in our archives. I'm the Lush who parties with talking animals and would like to give you one of my cards, Ryan Ellis. Cards? So antiquated, but this is 70 years ago. And here's my puka, my martini-loving wife, Bev.
That's me.
Doesn't really like martinis that much, but in the spirit of the movie, martinis is the drink of the day, every single day. So the coming attractions opinion for Harvey. If you had an imaginary friend, what form would you want that friend to take?
A bartender?
Also fits with the spirit of this movie,
yes.
Saying that. My answer, an arrogant little Pomeranian.
Oh, but you had a real arrogant little
Pomeranian
friend. It's true, he's gone now.
I have a backup answer. Alex Wagner. I just think she'd be cool to hang out with.
I know, I would love to be her friend in real life and even imaginary, just converse with her.
Also, Kerry Washington, you would say that she's on the list. Eva Longoria, all these people that have impressed me so much in recent years when you look at them and think, well, they can't possibly be smart and cool looking the way they do, but they are.
I'll have a martini with each and every one of them.
As would I. As would Jimmy Stewart and his drunk rabbit friend. Okay, The Six-Foot Rabbit was released by Universal a few weeks shy of 70 years ago on December 21st, 1950. It did pretty doggone well at the box office, although buying the play was expensive, so it wasn't a big hit because of that. Not the greatest return on investment like Us was. We talked about that a few weeks ago, where it cost a little and then made so much. Okay, Bev, the movie is so old, so please remind us what it's about with the Harvey Skinner.
Jimmy Stewart is Elwood P. Dowd, a wealthy gadabout whose best friend is a giant invisible rabbit named Harvey. This would be fine, except that Elwood is in the habit of getting blotto and then introducing Harvey to all of his sister Vita's high society friends, who naturally think he's gone off the deep end. So Vita attempts to have Elwood committed in an asylum that seems to have a very tenuous grasp on both psychiatric diagnoses and treatments. And since Vita is a woman expressing emotions, they naturally try to commit her instead. Calamity! All the while, Elwood remains unfazed as he is, whichever way you look at it, off his rocker.
Sometimes my nutshell is way off of what you say in the skinny, but this time they match up pretty well. So in a nutshell, moneyed matchmaker masks madness with welcoming weirdness while wasted. And he must be drunk all the time because apparently he drinks every single day. Although you only see Jimmy Stewart take a drink, it's said online once. I don't recall him drinking at all. And the reason why, the code, you couldn't show somebody actually getting blotto, even though they make it so clear that he drinks constantly. It would be the reverse, you would think, where he's drinking all the time but not showing effects of it, that they would let that go, or they'd have a, whatever, they might have a problem with that, too. But he never actually seems to drink anything, even though he talks like he's wasted, acts like he's wasted, and admits he's going to a bar all the time.
and they complain about him going to a bar. His sister is like, yeah, he clearly has a drinking problem. Curious if in the play, the stage play, they just showed him actually drunk all the time.
Probably. He's also hiding booze behind books in their library at home.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's a hider of booze. I mean, if that's not an alcoholic, I don't know what is.
One of the big characters and a very critical character in It's Wonderful Life, supporting role character at least, Mr. Gower, becomes a drunk in the alternate timeline Potterville sequences. Pottersville? That's it, anyway. And now Jimmy is a nice drunk because, of course, Mr. Gower is not having a very nice life. Anyway, the Rotten Tomatoes critics on Harvey, 85% of them like this movie. 23 fresh, only 4 rotten, for an average of 7.5 out of 10, but 27 reviews is not a huge sample size. 93% of audiences like this movie. Pretty excellent scores there. Won an Oscar. Josephine Hull, Best Supporting Actress, as Vita. She beat out Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter in All About Eve. Ritter's the best one of those three.
Man.
And also Nancy Olsen in Sunset Boulevard. Jimmy Stewart was nominated for Best Actor. He lost out to, well, he probably wasn't him that was second on that list, if you will. We don't know. But that was Jose Farrar in Cyrano de Bergerac. Harvey was 35th on the top 100 laughs. Some Like It Hot was number one. We covered Great Dictator last week. That was 37th. Take issue with those two being so high on that list. Being on the list, maybe, but that high. Harvey was 7th on the top 100 genres in the fantasy category. Wizard of Oz was number one. And it is really well done. And they don't do this on purpose. It's how people vote. But they had the sequence where I think it's Jimmy Stewart in the alley talking about meeting Harvey. And then it just dissolves into this thing in Field of Dreams where they talk about Harvey. They're watching Harvey in Field of Dreams. And that was the 6th ranked fantasy film on the genres list. So it was Harvey, then Field of Dreams. And it was a nice segue, which they couldn't have planned, but it worked out really well for them.
That's cool.
And the last AFI plaudit was it was nominated for the top 100 quotes with, well, I've wrestled with reality for 35 years, doctor, and I'm happy to state I finally won out over it, which is a pretty good quote. So I mentioned Josephine Hull's Oscar a few minutes ago. What do you think about that? And then the movie as a whole, I think your second time seeing it, right?
Yeah, it's my second time seeing it. Never should she have won over anybody in All About Eve, which is just such a superior film to this with superior performances. But I actually thought she was really wonderful. She's the only funny thing in this movie.
There are a few laughs that Jimmy Stewart has here and there.
Okay, I'm sure I got a chuckle here and there. To me, honestly, she's the hero of the movie for me. So put upon by her brother and this Pooka, she carries it on her back. I actually think she's the best thing in this movie. And unpopular opinion here, I don't think Stewart's performance is very good at all. I'm a hard no on this movie. A rare hard no. I think it's too long. It beats every joke to death. Its moral core is dubious at best. But the worst thing about it is Stewart's performance. He never for one second convinces me that Harvey is really there. And in fact, his performance is so sloppy and inconsistent that it cinematically disproves Harvey's existence.
You point out when we watched it that his pantomime isn't all that accurate.
That's a kind way to say it, isn't all that accurate. It's completely inconsistent. You've complained, and you're not alone, that he says over and over again that Harvey is 6'3.5", but Jimmy Stewart is 6'4", and yet is constantly looking up to talk at Harvey. But even that is inconsistent. Sometimes Harvey's taller than other times. Sometimes Harvey's fatter than other times. He always insists on putting his hand on his back and directing him places, but then he'll give him this wide space and then squeeze him through 1 foot of a doorway, and it seems to move to fit with doorways. And
even your stepmom wouldn't fit through that space sometimes.
And she's quite slight. Why didn't he do better? He made plenty of money making this movie. I saw the numbers and he had a share in this movie. Maybe take some coaching with miming. Maybe just spend an afternoon figuring out how to physically do this performance that requires so much of you physically. And beyond that, you already said it's probably the code. But is he drunk? Because he never acts drunk.
Yeah, he sounds like he's a little slurry sometimes. Especially as the day wears on. So it's said a few times that Harvey is 6'3.5". And you just said Stewart is 6'4". So he'd be looking right at him, if anything. Certainly not up. But Stewart envisioned he'd be 6'8". Harvey would. And I think that was supposed to be what everyone thought. So it was a script error. Remember in Double Indemnity, they said that Fred McMurray wore his wedding ring one day, and they thought, no, I guess it's just an error in this one scene. But it's on his finger, I think, in all the scenes. And I said to you when we did that podcast, one of our favorite movies from the original AFI list, that would be just part of his act, that I'm a married man, Mr. Smith. I'm a married man, Mr. Jones, Mrs. Watson. You can trust me.
To sell insurance.
Rather than Fred McMurray just wearing Fred McMurray's wedding ring in a scene. So it was a mistake, but it could have worked. But people online point out that he only did it once. He did it all the time. In this movie, too, how do you not recognize during shooting and either redo it, or if you don't want to redo it, then just be more consistent? I think it works in Double Indemnity against what they say online and what they were probably thinking back in 1943 or 44, whenever they made the movie, came out in 44. But in this case, learn to pantomime. You know what they would do now if they remade this movie? They'd have somebody, probably some big tall dude, stand beside, let's say, Jim Carrey. Seems like a logical choice to maybe do Elwood P. Dowd if they redid it. And then give him a reference point for where that guy's supposed to be. Don't have the cameras running. Do a rehearsal that way. Get rid of the tall guy. And then you know where you're supposed to be gesturing. You could argue it's supposed to be comedy, that sometimes Harvey has to squeeze into a tiny little space. I was reading that it was Jimmy Stewart's idea to have the camera framed to have Harvey on screen, quote unquote, the extra chair beside him in the asylum or in many scenes where Harvey's supposed to be. And that's great. But why wouldn't the filmmakers have thought of that in pre-production? Henry Koster, the director, his cinematographer, William Daniels.
I know that seems like a really obvious choice.
So I'm glad Stewart thought of it and he deserves credit, but it should have been somebody else that did think of that.
And you were talking about if they were going to make the movie today, how they would probably use technology to aid the actor keeping his eye line straight. But I also think that...
Wait, hang on one second. I wasn't saying special effects with the guy in a green suit. I just mean have a reference point and then get the guy out of there and then shoot with nothing. And Jim Carrey, for example, I'll keep on mentioning this name in this podcast a lot, I think, would be the kind of guy that, okay, my arm is like this for this scene. I'm looking up this way for this scene, and it's more consistent.
The other difference, and you say this all the time, that movies are better now, full stop. People can be nostalgic for the ways that movies were, but every person who makes movies in 2020 is better at their craft than they were in 1950. We've just raised our standards, and that goes for acting a lot. And I don't think any actor would have phoned it in like this.
Oh, I don't think he's phoning it in.
Really?
I think he's trying. We've now covered at least 7 Jimmy Stewart movies because I mentioned the 5 AFI films. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Philadelphia Story, It's a Wonderful Life, that's 3, right?
Vertigo.
Rear Window and Vertigo.
Rear Window, that's
the 2 Hitchcock films. And we've also done The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Maybe we've done another one, but that's 6 and now 7 Jimmy Stewart pictures. I've always said he's one of my favorite actors, but now as the years have gone on, and those AFI films for us are so long in our rear view, and even Man Who Shot Liberty Valance we covered years ago. But I don't like him as much as I used to, and it's partly because of the mannered, often over-the-top acting. It's a Wonderful Life, notwithstanding some of the best moments in Mr. Smith, which you didn't like that much.
He's a personality actor. You have to like Jimmy Stewart to like his performances.
And I do.
I don't object. I think that all of our greatest movie stars actually are really playing themselves to some extent, and we like them as movie stars because we like them. So I don't object to that style of a performer at all, but you still have to attempt to be naturalistic. I like his other performances lots. You just listed a bunch of them. I was thinking so much about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance today and how much I actually love his performance in that film. He's not an incredible character actor. He's not a man who slips into a role and disappears, but his charisma is what made him a movie star, and I find him very natural and watchable in most films he's in. This is an exception. Which is funny because he got lauded for this performance. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably fans of that movie who are listening to this who are cursing my name right now, and I gotta apologize, but this is just my opinion.
You should never apologize for your opinion, especially in a movie podcast. You gotta like what you gotta like. Apparently this is Jimmy Stewart's favorite role of his own. Certainly one of, anyway. I would not have nominated him for Best Actor for this, now that I've seen it 4 or maybe 5 times, because of what we said so far, that I don't think it's all that good a performance. It's funny that Henry Fonda was his best friend. When they were so politically opposite, Henry Fonda was the hardcore liberal, and Jimmy Stewart was, and I didn't know this until recently, the last maybe 5 or 6 years, the hardcore Republican, which wasn't so bad back in the day. And by the way, I wondered if Jimmy Stewart would be a hardcore Republican in 2020. Would he agree with their views now? This is the guy that apparently was spying on his neighbors and certainly agreed with John Wayne and other people that had to get them lousy commies out of Hollywood.
Yeah, he cooperated with HUAC, right?
And why wouldn't he when he believes what John Wayne believed, which is they're the real problem in America versus rich and powerful people, as we've talked about lots in our podcast, who are the bigger problem. Not that Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne are bringing down America in 1950, but those kinds of people weren't helping as much as they think they were, or making their country better. They were not. But I think Henry Fonda in this role, not that Henry Fonda should have done it, but just spitballing, would have been more believable, maybe. And I think a lot of modern actors could really hit this one out of the park, and Jim Carrey's the one I keep on coming up with. Maybe Kevin Kline would be fun in something like this also. Kevin Kline doesn't work enough. We got to get him in more roles.
I don't know. Maybe he works in theater a lot, because he started in theater, so maybe he went back to that. But we really don't see much of him anymore.
So I liked Jimmy Stewart more than you did, but not by that much. And it certainly was not worthy of a Best Actor nomination. And I'm surprised it's his favorite role of his own, because he was better in other things. As for Harvey being a pooka, and there's a lot of spellings of that online, but I always thought it was P-O-O-K-A. That's a creature from Celtic folklore, and it can be a bringer of good or bad luck. Obviously, it's a bringer of good luck for Elwood. And it suggested that Elwood was probably never a dick in the past, but not like this. And as much as he is maddening, he's a nice person. He's a sweetheart. He likes everybody. It's a nice touch that Mr. Cracker at Charlie's obviously has seen this scene probably every day, because it's the local watering hole for Harvey and Elwood. He treats Harvey as if he's just there. It's completely normal that this giant rabbit's there. And it's not suggested that he sees anything. He just buys into Elwood's delusion. But I wonder if in the past Elwood was not a dick, but maybe this is an unintentional tie to 4 years earlier, George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, because George Bailey is not an ass. Everybody loves the guy. But obviously, through all of his life fighting Mr. Potter and trying to keep his business afloat and running a house with a wife and 4 kids and trying to support his mother as well, it's been hard for him to do that. In some ways, I could see this movie not trying to tie back to that one. This is Universal, for one thing, and that wasn't, so there's no actual tie anyway with the studios. But it almost feels like, I was that guy, I learned a hard lesson at Christmas time, a great lesson, and I'm a different person.
Well, he has that great line near the end of the film where he says, oh, my mother always said that I have to choose between, I'm going to misquote it, I'll
can quote either it properly.
Have to be smart or pleasant.
I might leave some words out here, but I've got it written down, the majority of it at least. You must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me. I love that you may quote me part.
And he is definitely pleasant. It is his defining nature. I can see for people who love this film, probably what they love about it is just him. He seems like he would be a lovely guy to spend time with. At the end of the film, when Harvey chooses him over the doctor, yeah, of course you'd rather hang out with him. He's delightful. He seems to love everybody. He has this very generous and open nature. But unlike George Bailey, he doesn't have to worry about anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty easy for him to be kind and laid back and pleasant, as he says, because he hasn't got a worry in the world. As a matter of fact, he's so laid back and pleasant, he so cares about nothing, that he's screwing over people who do have worries. But he's ruining the lives of his sister Vita and her daughter Myrtle May.
By being the way he is.
Yeah, not like they're nice people. I can see how they're kind of villains in the sense that they're incredibly impatient with him. Their solution for most of the film is they want to just put him away in this mental institution and just see him as a problem that they need to deal with. But he's a problem that they need to deal with. In their defense, what are they supposed to do in this circumstance? They have to rely on him. They don't have money of their own. They can't be pleasant. They have to not hustle, but it matters to them that they have a place in society, whether it's about society or not. Myrtle wants to get married. She's a young woman. She wants to find love. And her crazy uncle is ruining all of her chances at finding a husband. And he could care less. The question that this film seems to be presenting for at least the first 3 quarters of it, before it becomes very obvious in the end that Harvey is real. I don't think there's any debate you could possibly have suggesting that he's actually imaginary. No. The movie is saying Harvey is real. But before the movie makes that clear, the question is Harvey real or is Elwood completely imagining him and this is all going on in his head? Is he crazy or is he sane? Well, I say it doesn't matter if Harvey's real or not. His behavior is still completely insane because if he's seen an imaginary rabbit, obviously on his face, that's mentally ill. But if Harvey's real, he still doesn't understand that nobody else can see him or that there's something socially disruptive about walking in a room and introducing everybody to your invisible friend that nobody can see, hear, touch, smell. They seem to walk right through him, and he doesn't see anything wrong with this. And when his sister and his niece are distressed, he can just completely ignore it. Like, that's also pathological.
Yeah, Edward's pretty selfish without trying to be selfish. He is the one at the end. No, I don't want him to have that shot. I've known people like that who don't care about anyone. Because it's the cab driver, Wallace Ford, who plays Logfrin. That's what it says online. I think he said something else. But it says Ellis. Ellis Logfrin is his character's name. I bring them out here, they're nice, and then when they go back, they ain't nice at all. And she doesn't want that for her brother, which is a nice touch. And should anyone want a nice guy to take drugs to probably keep him from being nice again? If he's not hurting anyone, then probably not. But this movie does argue in the end for mental illness and delusions. You're saying Harvey's real, and he is, but if he's real, then why do only Elwood and Dr. Chumley see him? That could be argued. I guess he shows himself to people that he wants to. But it is a bit of a plot, and everybody's in on it. Because at the end, everybody ends up buying Edward's delusion. They're all for it. It reminds me a little bit, and this was almost going to be the nutshell, of Lars and the Real Girl. So this would be Lars and the Real Rabbit. The difference in that is that everybody has to pretend, and they don't seem to have a problem with pretending that the blow-up doll is a real person. And they take her out in the town with them for the day. That's where I drew the line with that movie. I thought, okay, fine, you want to appease Ryan Gosling's character when he's around. I get it. But when he's not there, is he sitting in the recliner beside us, beside Sam, stroking him? No, it's a blow-up doll.
It's two very opposing attitudes about how we interpreted mental illness in the 50s versus how we do in the 21st century, where in the 50s, it's absolutely cruel. They're making the assumption that Elwood is crazy, or when they're making the assumption that Vita is crazy. Their solution to the problem is to strip them naked and throw them in a bathtub.
Bathe them.
That's the first thing
they
do.
Dirt is the problem.
So you're just right off the bat humiliating them and abusing them. What is this? And then they give them a drug that turns them into a jerk and even just institutionalizing them right off the bat. And it seems like none of these doctors have any idea what they're doing. They have no idea who's sick or why, and they don't seem to know the reasoning behind these cruel treatments they're putting their patients through. Also that when Vita and Myrtle think that Elwood is crazy, they're put upon. This is a tragic thing that happened to them, that they had a crazy uncle. When they talk about society shunning them because they have a crazy member in their family, nobody's saying, oh, society is wrong for feeling this way. I don't even think the movie is presenting this argument that it would be wrong to shun this entire family because one member appears to be mentally ill. The movie just kind of accepts this to be true that, yeah, of course, mental illness would ruin a family. That's their problem to deal with. And that's why the stakes are very high without ever really questioning that attitude. Versus Lars and the Real Girl, where it is the complete opposite to the point where you're arguing that Lars and the Real Girl takes it too far and that they are too accommodating of his mental illness. I agree with you, by the way, about Lars and the Real Girl, where at that point in the movie, you're like, give me a break. And that's how far the pendulum has swung from the 50s to now. And that could be another reason why this movie is hard to watch. Not like I agree with Lars and the Real Girl and their
attitude.
It's pretty
dated, though, this is.
But this, going back and watching it, it can be, like, pretty upsetting to just see the language and the attitudes, to see that that's how they would treat somebody who seems to be in crisis somehow, even if it was just that he had a drinking problem. But then they're like, oh, drinking rots your brain. The end. Throw them in the tub.
People reacted weird to insanity back in this era, though, in movies anyway. Maybe not in reality, but in movies. Especially in Jimmy Stewart movies. Remember in It's a Wonderful Life when Clarence first shows up and they've both been in the water? So the, whatever he is, the bridge worker, dock guy, whatever he is helping them out. And then Clarence talks about being an angel and he's hundreds of years old. And the way that guy overplays it so hard and then runs away as if Clarence is going to, I don't know, rape him or something.
Yeah,
or
the assumption
kill him.
That if you are a little unhinged with reality, then you are automatically dangerous.
And that's why I like Mr. Cracker in this, because he's obviously seen it for a while with Elwood and supposedly Harvey. You're saying he's real, and you're right. I got to get my mind around that fact that in the movie's logic, he's real. That's true. But Mr. Cracker's reaction to it, so matter of fact, I'm bringing over two martinis, not one. That's the way to handle it, I guess, especially if you're going to like Elwood, who wouldn't like Elwood, and you want his business. But the way
I
that some
he's
people...
a generous tipper.
That helps, yeah. But some people in this movie, It's a Wonderful Life, and probably plenty of others I can't think of right now, so overreact to someone not being quite all there as if they're going to infect you with their supposed insanity.
How many years later is Cuckoo's Nest?
75, so that's 25
years later. So 25 years later, and you have a movie that's certainly more, I want to say realistic, and that's a relative term, but it's more realistic about mental illness and life in an asylum than Harvey is.
Oh yeah, by a mile.
But it has equally disparaging views of doctors and nurses, how professionals treat the mentally ill.
Miss Kelly would rather sleep with her boss or the doctor who's her superior, Dr. Sanderson, and just talk to her patients. That's actually a nice scene when they're in the booth and Harvey's not there anymore. There's a big chunk in the movie where Harvey's not with Elwood because he's with Dr. Chumley. But earlier in the night, Dr. Chumley, Elwood, and Harvey were all in the booth at Charlie's. But now it's Sanderson and Kelly and Wilson, the New Yorker, who obviously, this isn't a New York set film. I don't think it's supposed to be anywhere near there. No one sounds like they're from there except for Jesse White playing the flapjack-wielding orderly, who seems like he came directly from Brooklyn, the Bronx, somewhere in New York anyway. But he doesn't help that scene by being the way he is. But when Sanderson and Kelly are just talking to Elwood, it's actually pretty sweet. But at the same point, Elwood crosses the line with her a little bit. He doesn't do anything Me Too-wise. I wouldn't say that.
He's flirting with her.
But he's flirting with her. He's always talking about her looks. He's holding her hand. That's okay. It's not that big a deal. But it's still not the right thing to do when you were a patient. Although he doesn't look at himself as a patient from earlier in the day. And I both like those scenes because Kelly and Sanderson are so sweet with him, which is probably the best way to handle this. But also that's not what a nurse really is supposed to do. But then the doctor's setting the tone. He's also, he thinks, been fired by Chumley. So he's doing his last deed, and he's a doctor, so he thinks he has to help this guy, who really doesn't need help. The best scene in the movie for a lot of people, I don't know if it's my favorite scene, but the one in the alley, and I'm pretty sure it's Jim Carrey in one of the AFI shows. It could have been the fantasy genres, could have been the Top 100 Laughs. I think it was the Laughs, but whatever it was. I remember Jim Carrey marveling about how Jimmy Stewart plays the alley scene, explaining how he met Harvey. And it's not funny, but it is touching and sweet. And then that's when Sanderson brings up about how, what was your father's name? And I had taken a note earlier in the movie. I bet that's his father's name. And then Sanderson says it, and I'd forgotten that he did. But then it's also speculated by Sanderson that it might have been a childhood friend. Elwood just says he liked the name Harvey. So, okay. But if you go by Freudian terms, it had to have been something from his past that might have been bad, but more likely was good. And that person's not in his life anymore. Either they're dead or they're just not there anymore. So that's why he's Harvey, because the Pooka even says, what do you want my name to be? Mr. Dowd. And Elwood says, Harvey. So that's why he's Harvey. So for Chumley, the brief time he spent with him, he could be something else, although Chumley's probably going to call him Harvey. But it could have been that he's Bob or Betty or any other name, because it doesn't have to be Harvey. It's what you want it to be. Although with Chumley, it seems like Harvey's not, as I said earlier, it can be a bad time you can have with him. So it's not that. But it's not the good time Elwood has either. It's somewhere between. Chumley is afraid of this rabbit. And the one time we see the proof that Harvey must be there, again in this movie's universe, is because doors are opening and things are happening. The hat in Chumley's office that's clearly supposed to be Harvey's hat with the two holes in it for the ears. The one piece of proof that Harvey's there is involving Chumley. And Chumley seems like he's both terrified and also intrigued by this rabbit. And that's not Elwood's response at all.
So right before Chumley and Harvey go off together, Elwood is explaining to him that Harvey has the ability to stop time,
right,
and take you anywhere you want and control the circumstances and basically fulfill your fantasies.
Marty! Got the DeLorean!
He personally doesn't want to do that. He just wants Harvey's company, which I actually find the most touching part of the film, that he could have the power of the universe, mm-hmm, at his fingertips, but he just wants to go to the bar and hang out with Harvey and make friends with literally everybody he, mm-hmm, meets. So Harvey goes off with Chumley, and then minutes later, not even minutes later, is back with Elwood. And you think immediately, you're like, oh, wow, Chumley just really got ripped off. But then they could have spent weeks or months or years together. We don't know. They stopped the clock.
Yeah.
Chumley probably got his fantasy. I can't remember. There's a woman he wanted to, like, stroke his hair and tell him everything will be all right or something and go to, where was it, Akron? That's got to be something from his past. You don't just pull that out of nowhere. So he wants to experience this cathartic moment with his fantasy. And that could have absolutely happened. He said he wanted 2 weeks, right? So he probably spent 2 weeks with Harvey, but for us, it went by in a second because Harvey stopped the clock. And then he does his good deed, Harvey does, and then he goes and he hangs out with his friend. He could be doing this over and over with all kinds of people. Maybe he did it with the bartender.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, nice idea, because he's not with Elwood for a big chunk of the night in the basically day this movie is set. It's pretty much a day in the life of with all these people, or maybe it's a couple of days. Anyway, a very short period of time. And Elwood's not around Harvey the whole time. So yeah, Harvey could be doing so much when he's not around Elwood.
He should do something nice for Vida, I say.
I wonder if Chumley knows that Harvey bailed on him. Even if he had that great experience, he might still think, well, we'll still hang out together and I'll do it again. And wait a minute.
But he's scared of Harvey. I don't even think he would want to be friends with Harvey. He wants to take advantage of his powers. But he's not friends with him the way Elwood is.
Doctor sense my power. I'm not afraid of doctors, Mandrake. The sci-fi concept in this movie is an interesting part of it that I think a lot of people forget about. I haven't seen this movie in so many years that I'd forgotten about that whole concept. That you can spend time with Harvey. It could be a blink of an eye. But you've had a whole experience. So it is very fitting to at least be nominated for the fantasies list, which I like a lot on the genres list of the 10 top 10s. I didn't write down all of them, but I said Wizard of Oz was number one. I believe Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring is number two. I said Field of Dreams is six. We know this is seventh. So this has sci-fi fantasy type elements, obviously more fantasy than anything else. But it makes a person, at least me, want to know more about what Harvey can really do. If they remade this movie today, you'd have to deal with the mental illness situation differently. You're saying, and I guess I agree with you, that Harvey's really there in this movie's universe. But let's just say that most people believe that he's mentally ill. Because even though most people that we see in this movie end up believing in Harvey, certainly Chumley does, Vida eventually seems to, or at the very least she believes in her brother. Myrtle May's got Martin Wilson now, the orderly, so she's happy enough. Those two click immediately. She makes a great egg and onion sandwich.
What is an egg and onion sandwich?
Even an egg sandwich sounds weird to me.
Weird 50s food.
Yeah, two separate things. But if we made the movie now, and I've mentioned Jim Carrey a few times, and I said why, because he talks about this movie in one of the AFI shows. Would it be Tom Hanks?
Oh, I know. Jimmy Tom Hanks Stewart is like comparison? The first thing that comes to mind. Always with Jimmy Stewart, your mind goes to Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks is a better actor than Jimmy Stewart was. Although Jimmy Stewart was in some great movies, and a lot of them had deeper type concepts or even sci-fi concepts. We say Vertigo, you talked about this before. We've mentioned this a lot in our podcasts. The maybe last third of that movie or even more than that is not real. That when he goes to the asylum, the rest of the movie could just be this fever dream he has. It's Wonderful Life.
That he plays out in his head. Yeah.
It's Wonderful Life where there's an angel and an alternate timeline. But the movie portrays, it's been, he's standing on the bridge. I'm going to kill myself. And then I want to live, God. Please let me live, God.
There's the fantasy of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where a principled man can actually turn the tide of, is it the Senate or the House? I can't remember.
It's the Senate.
It's the Senate. Even more corrupt.
And the Mitch McConnell of his day. No, I'm guilty. Don't frame that boy. I'm going to shoot up everything and take me away.
Oh, senators that can experience shame? That's too much of a fantasy for me. It's too far-fetched.
That was controversial, too, as we talked about in that podcast long ago. So do you think Hanks, then? I've mentioned Carrie. Is it somebody else that might be able to pull this off? You know, actually might be fun. Just popped in my head. Donald Glover. Maybe a little too young still to play a character like this. But he's got that out there weirdness and goofiness that can maybe play this pretty well. Tom Hanks is more grounded than Jimmy Stewart is, at least in this movie.
And we've been rewatching Community and really seeing Donald Glover play guilelessly sweet. Which Elwood certainly, if there's one word to describe him, it would be guileless. So yeah, that's actually a good point, Donald Glover, because I had Atlanta Donald Glover in my head for a second, but no, he's definitely capable of pulling that off.
Childish Gambino could maybe play that character.
You know, one of the big inspirations from this movie has got to be on The Simpsons, and they've done homages to Harvey in different ways and small ways, but in one episode at least, and one of the better ones of the early seasons, at least as far as the outlook goes, and that would be Leon Komposki in the Michael Jackson episode. Yes.
The Cuckoo's Nest episode.
Effectively, yeah. He is inspired, I think, at least by Elwood's outlook, to just talk like this. And the world's better. People looked at me differently. People treated me differently. Until the end of the episode, he reveals he's Leon Kompowski, a bricklayer from Paterson, New Jersey. But before that, he was Michael Jackson of the Jacksons. And Elwood is the same kind of attitude in this, which is, I can be angry and hate the world, which is where I feel all the time. Ryan Ellis feels that way all the time. I'd like to feel like Elwood does and Leon Kompowski does, and I can't do it. It's probably going to be impossible by the time this podcast gets posted because we do this before the election. And whatever happens after this election, it's not going to be good. And we may be Canadian, but I might go insane in November 2020 from whatever's going to happen. But I wish I could feel like Elwood Dow does.
Well, maybe if you had inherited enough money that you could just start drinking in the morning every day and never have to go to work or worry about anything and be able to be generous and invite everybody you meet to dinner. Yeah, maybe we'd all be happy if we literally did not have a care in the world the way that Elwood does.
The movie doesn't say that wordly, but I have a feeling that Elwood was a tough businessman. Not a bad guy, probably. But worked too much, was stressed too much. And maybe that's why he's as wealthy as he is. He inherited something from his parents. His mother obviously loved him. He talks about her a few times. But it could be that he was also that, let's make more money, let's do the thing, let's be the American dream and work hard. And then he was about to explode or implode or something. And then something inside of him popped. And again, in the movie sense, Harvey's really there. But whatever it is, mental illness and delusion, or a giant puka is actually saying, let it go, let it go. Or a Clarence type, which is, you're going to, maybe not literally, but figuratively die unless you fix yourself right now, and I'll help you do that.
He's drinking himself to death.
Probably. Well, that's what happens next, I think.
Yeah.
Whenever Harvey does leave Elwood, Mr. Dowd will start hating the world again. Mr. Dowd. Or maybe he'll just always be this blissfully ignorant man who skates through life in 1950s small town America. All white people. Is there any black person in the whole town? I don't think so. Either way, Elwood will die of alcohol poisoning sooner rather than later. One fairly clever touch is when Elwood gets to the asylum and Sanderson and Kelly think that he's fine and Vita's the one who should be hospitalized, especially Sanderson. They delay, the filmmakers do, having Elwood introduce Harvey, which he wants to do with everybody. And now I'd like to introduce you to my friend Harvey. And he tries to, but there are reasons why it doesn't get out of his mouth fully. Sanderson and Kelly don't actually meet Harvey, despite Elwood's attempts to make them meet him. For a while, anyway. He does a few things they should notice, like the elbowing Harvey in the ribs, that kind of stuff. But for the most part, that works pretty well. Just like the exposition early on, especially Vita. Josephine Hull has to carry a lot of the story early on. But she doesn't do any of that, well, as a Secretary of Defense type stuff on Independence Day that poor Robert Lozier had to say. It mostly is organic enough. It's not great. Exposition rarely is, but it's all right, I thought. But I also thought that was okay the way they set it up, that Elwood obviously is seeing something that, to them, isn't there. But the people that need to see that don't. But Vita getting hospitalized and them not seeing that is a Three's Company-esque misunderstanding plot.
Maybe they kept interrupting him because at that point they realized that nobody in this family can tell a story directly. This is part of the reason I didn't like this movie, and this is
very personal.
A personal thing. I know it's supposed to be played for laughs, the fact that nobody can get through a story without an elaborate and deeply unnecessary aside. Vita's like, oh, I used to change his diapers. You see, babies need their diapers changed. And I know Elwood had a good one just like that, too, where they would just stop the story dead in the middle to explain something tragically obvious to the...
My mother always called me Elwood.
Why wouldn't she? It's your name.
As opposed to Johnny or Fred or something.
Why wouldn't she call you Elwood? What a stupid thing. Tell the story. What's wrong with you? So anyway, I was raised by a woman.
Who still does this now, by the way.
Who her whole life has never been able to just tell a story. And like all mothers, she annoys me more than any other human. And she just drives me crazy with her inability to tell a direct story. And when I watch something like this, I can't handle it. It's not funny.
You're thinking, Linda, just make your point there. Make it. Please make your point,
Linda. Oh, my God. Just tell the story. We know babies need their diapers. What's wrong with you?
We should start calling your mother Mrs. Dowd because, of course, Vita is a Dowd also, but she was married. Which is why she's Vita Louise Dowd Simmons. So Vita Simmons, and of course Myrtle May Simmons, the father is not in the picture, and I don't think they explain where he is. Vita's ex, or maybe dead husband. Could have died in the war, I guess, if the movie's supposed to be contemporary to 1950.
Hmm. my sister and I have turned the word Linda into a verb for anybody who just cannot get to the point. Speaking of The Simpsons, I have the shorthand where whenever my mom gets into this mode, oh, she's saying there's an onion on her belt.
Grandpa Simpson, yeah.
It's a grandpa. She's Grandpa Simpsoning all over the story.
And the Myrtle May at least physically resembles, and in some other ways too, but physically resembles your stepmother.
Totally.
So very true. Thin and very, well, not very tall.
She didn't raise me, so she doesn't get under my skin at all the way my mom does.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that would bother you a little bit because this movie is an hour 45-ish, I guess, and it probably could be an hour 20.
It suffers from Saturday Night Live syndrome where it takes a joke that would have been funny if the scene was a minute and a half long, and then it does that for four straight minutes. It just drags out every joke you talk about. The scene where he keeps trying to introduce Harvey and he just can't. It just goes on and on and on.
The drug that they're supposed to give Elwood, by the way, which takes forever to prepare. We just got our flu shots a couple of hours ago. And we were in and out of the hospital in maybe half an hour, both of us combined. But this shot takes forever to prepare. The cab driver has to give Vita his explanation for why it's bad that Elwood would get the shot. But it's formula 977. That Sanderson wants to shock Elwood back to reality. And of course, I'm not for that because even though there's either something wrong with him or he's a drunkard or whatever it is with Harvey, you'd rather he be a nice person. And I do think the movie's saying that he may not have been as stressed as George Bailey was, but it was something on that level. Why do we have to have all these kids? Although we always love that line and agree with it.
I have to say for the record, because I always feel like psychiatric drugs are maligned unnecessarily. I have taken antidepressants in the past, and I am not on them now, but I'm pretty sure I was a nicer person when I was on antidepressants than I am now.
It doesn't help that the world is bad and getting worse.
Yeah, I think that my drug of choice is going to be martinis from now on. Maybe that's why he's so cheerful. He's just drunk all the time.
Well, that is definitely a reason why. Well, this is supposed to be Funny Movie Month. Did you think the movie was funny enough to make the comedies list? Not 35th. I certainly wouldn't put it there, but...
Short answer, no. It's not like I didn't laugh. I got a couple chuckles out of this. But it's not really that funny. It's not just that comedy ages poorly. I feel like this was old-fashioned even for 1950.
Yeah.
We could just compare it next to All About Eve, which is actually very funny.
And wasn't even nominated for the comedy
list.
Yeah,
it's not even considered straight up a comedy.
Sunset Boulevard also was funnier than this.
Totally.
Same year.
Yes, there you go. Those are two movies that also feel way more modern than this film does. It's from a play which was written in the early 40s, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's not even like the play came way before the movie, but it feels like one of those plays that was written in the end of the 19th century. It's incredibly old-fashioned.
Pulitzer Prize winning play by Mary Chase.
It has some very nice lyrical dialogue. And I don't know if it's a translation to the screen where it fails.
You know the best scenes in the movie are when Harvey's not present.
Yeah, yeah.
The scene with Elwood in the booth with Sanderson and Kelly. And Wilson's not helping exactly in that scene because he's annoying, I think, and a little bit too much. But he's supposed to be that way in that scene. And then in the alley, when Wilson's not present, and Sanderson and Kelly are listening to how Elwood met Harvey, which I think is a lovely scene. Maybe not that funny, but a lovely scene. And Elwood with the doctor explaining what Harvey can do for him. That's pretty good stuff. Vita and Myrtle May with various different people when Elwood's not present, but especially when Harvey's not with him. That's pretty good stuff. The movie almost could have just been a simple drama with some laughs rather than selling itself as a comedy and then somehow making the comedies list, especially 35th, and it might have been a more effective film.
I bet back in 1950, moms loved this movie.
We've talked about The Simpsons and It's Wonderful Life connections, of course, of this film. Donnie Darko has a giant rabbit.
Although he denied it. The director of Donnie Darko, he said he had never seen Harvey. There was no connection whatsoever.
Well, still, the giant rabbit is a very key part of the plot. Field of Dreams, we said already, of course, too. And there are a ton of references in other movies and in TV shows. Look those up online if you want to see many of those. The Simpsons have done it a few different times, in fact. Sometimes subtly.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit does a little,
mm-hmm.
Where's the rabbit? Oh, he's right here. Harvey. Mm-hmm. Like you sit in the imaginary rabbit next to him.
It's mentioned in A Beautiful Mind as well, when Russell Crowe's character is finally on drugs and mentions his friend Harvey sitting beside him.
It's shorthand for an imaginary friend now. Yeah.
And of course, this has been remade several times too, and it cries out, I think, for another remake today. But done a little differently, a little more sensitivity to what his condition must be, because even if there is a rabbit that he sees, like we said, that should at least be acknowledged this whole notion behind, I want to introduce you, just that no one can see. Vida and Myrtle May aren't the only people, and he should know this by now. Although if he's always sauced, maybe that's why he doesn't recognize it. But maybe make it a little bit more dramatic with some laughs rather than what this movie's going for, which is a pretty steady amount of laughs and doesn't even have that in the first place.
They owe us an explanation for why Elwood seems oblivious to the wake of chaos he leaves behind him.
Jimmy Stewart did play this role in London and also on Broadway later on in his career as well. They talked about Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, Gary Cooper, Jimmy Cagney, and there was talk of a remake a while back with Travolta. Oh yeah, there's a good name too. Maybe not now, but several years ago, Travolta, the late 90s, even before that, I could see him pulling this off. Travolta, you talk about sweetness. That dude, even now, a little tainted with the Scientology stuff, but he could pull off sweetness pretty well. And he's also now lived a hard life in recent years. A lot of people die on him in his life, including his son, not that long ago. And long ago, his girlfriend in the 70s.
And his wife this year.
Oh, right. Kelly Preston died, yeah, too. Oh, my God. Yeah, I think he could really access some emotions. It's too bad Travolta seems to be played for Hollywood, doesn't get great roles anymore, because you think that he could really be the Joe Biden, somebody who's experienced some really terrible things and doesn't hate the world, but seems to have more empathy in the world. Joe Biden certainly seems to have that. Josephine Hull was in the play, so in the early 40s, or mid-40s at least, that Mary Chase wrote. She's way older than Jimmy Stewart. She was born way back in the 1800s, so she's almost a senior citizen in this film. But then Jimmy Stewart, for somebody who was around 42-ish, 44, whatever it was, looks older. And that could be because he went through the war, something like 4 or 5 years he was overseas fighting, and probably drank in reality and smoked and all that kind of stuff that may have aged him. But I'm finally aging now, but do I look like Jimmy Stewart's age in
God,
this movie?
No. Oh my God, no.
There you go. Josephine Hull only made 5 movies, though, including Arsenic and Old Lace. You'd think that after an Oscar win, she'd get all kinds of offers, and maybe she did, but only 5 movies ever.
Well, she was a theater actress, so maybe stuck to the theater. I truly did love her performance. I think she's the best thing in the movie.
A little shrill, but fun.
Well, you just nailed it on the head, because as much as I thought her performance was great, truly, by the end of this film, I would commit myself to a sanitarium if Amanda had to listen to her voice for one more minute.
Victoria Horne plays Myrtle May, desperately horny Myrtle May, but it looks like it's going to work out with her and the tough New Yorker.
Also known as the first man to pay attention to her ever. Not even in a cute, romantic way. Doesn't he grab ass?
Off screen, we hear a woo kind of sound. Yeah. And you asked me what was going on. I said, he's probably grabbing her bum.
Right, right.
She did The Ghost and Mrs. Muir before this and a lot of thrillers, incidentally. Which is also true of Peggy Dow, who is horny for Lyman, Dr. Sanderson. She did quite a few noir films and some comedies, but only made 9 flicks in total. And she's fine. I thought she could have been more of a player than she was in the business. But Cecil Kellaway, who is Dr. Chalmley, made over 100 movies in 36 years. And he was in Wuthering Heights and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. That was a more major role in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Those are both AFI films. Charles Drake is Dr. Sanderson, who worked with Stewart quite a bit. And was also in Yankee Doodle Dandy, which we covered years ago for the Top 100 project. The director, Henry Koster, did 49 films, including The Bishop's Wife and a lot of other comedies, but this is probably his best-known title. I mentioned Mary Chase wrote it along with Oscar Brodny, who wrote The Glenn Miller Story, which was a Jimmy Stewart film where he played Glenn, guess, Miller. And Chase won a Pulitzer Prize for this, which we've never seen the play, obviously, but really, Pulitzer Prize. Okay. The producer, John Beck, only produced 9 movies, and they were mostly comedies. The movies won 3-7-1, so the old Academy ratio. We saw the black and white DVD that we own. Seemed okay to me for a movie so old. Cinematographer William Daniels did 163 films, a lot with Jimmy Stewart, and also A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which we covered a couple of years ago, the Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor film. The editor, Ralph Dawson, cut The Adventures of Robin Hood in 1938, which we covered a few years ago. Bev really hated that one. And won an Oscar for A Midsummer Night's Dream in the 30s. The composer, Frank Skinner, did 264 films as a composer, 5 Oscar nominations, and he worked on a lot of different genres. I don't remember the music in this film. What'd you think of the technicals, though?
They're fine. They don't get in the way.
Moving on.
Nothing that impressive about them. They really stand out.
All right, so you're not a fan of this film. I like it more than you, but if I had to rank it, and we don't usually do this, I'd give it a 7. It'd be a soft 7. Partly for the gentle, nice scenes. And I got to say, as I think I did a minute ago, that whenever Harvey's not, quote unquote, on screen, the movie's better for it, even though the movie's called Harvey.
I can see how if I was in the right mood and maybe, I don't know, had had an edible or something, I would find his attitude could feel just like a warm hug. His character and his whole essence would be so comforting under the right circumstances, but I just cannot get there.
I'm going to ask you this question, and it applies to both people, but do you mean Harvey or Elwood?
Elwood. Harvey, we never have any sense of Harvey.
But what he is to Elwood seems to be what you just said.
Sure, that's fair, but the audience doesn't really get to know Harvey at all. You know that Elwood likes him, but Elwood likes everybody, so...
He's inviting everybody over to their house for dinner the next day or within the next week, and there are people that...
Which is a crime. Some cases, I'm sorry. You meet somebody at a bar, and you have a little conversation, and then they immediately invite you over to dinner. No, that is a social crime.
And the one guy's just out of jail, too, which doesn't mean he should be ostracized forever, but that's a little different than inviting somebody over who you've known for a little while. Let's be friends, more friends. The guy who runs the gate at the asylum... Come on over, we're having a dinner party.
That guy who runs the gate has a life. The doctor who runs the asylum has a life.
I don't think the guy who runs the gate does, because he says yes to going over. Certainly the barfly does, too.
I guess he is more inclined to invite people who seem to be hard up for friends, so then it's a kindness.
I get the feeling that Elwood himself, long ago, was also hard up for friends, but that's because he was not a nice guy.
He only has one friend in the movie, really. Despite how nice he is to everybody, it seems like Harvey is his only friend. And he has a Canadian girlfriend, I hear, too.
Well, again, that's the way he plays George Bailey to some degree, where he has all these friends, but he's a busy man, probably doesn't really see them all that much.
But at least they're real.
Except for Clarence. Well, he was real. He was an angel. The movie's slight, it's silly, it's quite dated, and Jimmy is in mega laying it on thick mode. But the film's enjoyable, and it's nice it does have some laughs, because a lot of the old comedies just don't. And I did hear you laughing, and that was pleasant to me, because, oh, pleasant comes up again. This has as many laughs as The Great Dictator, but To Be or Not to Be, we talked about that last week when we did The Great Dictator, is funnier than this is. And next week's movie, if you want four or five big laughs in the span of about 3 minutes... then you're going to have to download us in 7 days because we'll be discussing Monty Python and the Holy Grail. We did Life of Brian 2.5 years ago, I think it was, and we talked about Holy Grail quite a bit in that one. That's right. We talked about Holy Grail plenty. We're Life of Brian people, but Holy Grail has a lot of good laughs in it too. So the coming attractions, trivia. It is trivia, and it's about the Oscars because that's my fallback. Only two Pythons were ever nominated for Oscars. Which two and for what?
All right, so for the answer to that question, tune in next week for our podcast about Monty Python.
Run away! And run the away! Holy Grail.
And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen to us. All our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. And hundreds more titles on top of that.
A lot of Jimmy Stewart back in those old episodes.
In exchange for all of this great content, Jimmy Stewart and otherwise, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Well, you must be oh so snarky or oh so pleasant. I recommend snarky.
And you may quote me.
And cut.